Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Thursday, the 20th of March, and very stirring music. Listening to Lindsey Stirling this morning. Stirling. Oh, you get it.
Very good.
See, I didn't mean that, but
it worked.
It happened anyway. So, good morning, all. Welcome to the program. I hope you are doing well, and we're very glad to be in your company this morning. We have a great group. Let me introduce them to you, and we will get started for a busy Thursday. We welcome your letters, as always. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we look forward to see what you have in store for us today. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois is to my immediate left. Hello, Teresa. How are you?
Well, you know, I'm doing okay. It's the happy Founders Day for the Republican Party. I wonder, you know, how all those founders would feel about the Republican Party today. But in any case, 171 years ago. Happy Founders Day.
Indeed. Happy Founders Day and happy...
Or not.
Happy Thursday to you.
Happy Thursday.
Teresa. Bill Hammond is here, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, Joe.
Great to have you back.
Pleased to be here.
Thank you very much, as always. Mark Whitman returns, investment banker on Wall Street, and here with his son, George, who is off school for the week and had joined us on Monday and is back again today. We couldn't be more thrilled. Good morning. How are you both?
Good. Just happy my key card worked this morning.
Oh, good. Is that a problem, usually?
Every time I come here, I always wonder when you guys are going to turn it off. That's all.
Oh, well, Jesus, I've been worried about that for 30 years, Mark. And when it doesn't work, you're like, oh, well, that was it. Yeah, that was a good run.
In banking, we used to say when you enter the bank, they shoot a bullet into the bank at the exact same time, and it bounces around, and at some point, inevitably, you and your bullet meet, and that's the end.
What a lovely metaphor.
Oh, my
That's very,
goodness.
Very nice.
That.
Your violence may vary. And we're thrilled to have Kristen Van Genhoven with us, a theater artist, arts activist, arts advocate, activist, and executive director for Project Sage in Lakeville, Connecticut. I will also add to her very prestigious credits that she is Canadian, and we are more than a little interested in what she has on her mind this morning. Good morning, Kristen. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me. I'm actually driving to Canada right after this. So, I don't know, this may be the last time I'm ever on this show. We'll see if they let me back in.
Well, it depends on whether you become the 51st state or not, right?
Ay, ay, ay. Joe, please. Please, better.
We'll get to that later. Okay, let's get started this morning. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Kristen, never expect better. we've drawn the lines of this show. We just do the best we get. Good morning, all. Welcome. And let's get started with the dismantling of the Education Department. Trump is said to sign an order aimed at dismantling the Education Department. Now, this is something that he's been talking about for a very long time. It's something that we saw when the head of the Department of Education was named, Linda McMahon, immediately erased half the staff in that department. So that was certainly a sign that things were moving in this particular direction. Now, the president plans to sign an executive order instructing Education Secretary Linda McMahon to begin dismantling the agency. The department cannot be closed without the approval of Congress. Exactly. The department cannot be closed.
Sorry.
Oh, I just had an idea.
Even my phone is upset about it.
Hey, Ray, the great gazoo just came into the studio.
I thought I turned it off. I'm sorry. We'll try again.
The department cannot be closed without the approval of Congress, which created it. But the Trump administration has already taken steps to narrow the agency's authority and significantly cut its workforce while also telegraphing plans to try and shutter it. The White House officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to speak publicly about the plans said the order instructed Ms. McMahon to return authority over education to the states. USA Today was the first to report Mr. Trump's intent to sign the order on Thursday. Teresa Bourgeois, what do you make of this?
The daughter of two teachers. Can you imagine what I make of this? Well, first of all, the education really is under the direct education is under the power of the states and localities. So that argument is false. This has been something that they've talked about for a long, long time. But I don't think anyone thought that they would actually do it. But here they are as they are dismantling so many other things. What interests me is, well, when Trump, first of all, who he appointed as a secretary, someone who has no background in education, right? No understanding of what the department does. Couldn't even answer basic questions on just general structure of the education department. It's interesting. I went to the website last night to try to look some things up, and a lot of it is their org chart is in progress, it says, and many vacancies, many changes. But what is the impact on this? What does it really do? It funds a whole. It does research that state and local governments rely on. It provides funding for loans and grants to go to school. So what happens to that function? Who's going to manage all those student loans and student grants? It provides support for special needs students. There was a civil rights division, but they dismantled that the first day, so I guess we're not concerned about civil rights anymore. There is a higher education function. One has to step back and ask, really, why this attack on education, K through 12 education, higher education? They are attacking education from the research perspective. They're attacking education now by targeting students at universities, deporting them in sort of these show of displays of whatever it is, not strength, weakness, I think. And what's the impact? And I was thinking about last night about young people today who they had to live through the pandemic, which was very traumatic, and now they're living through this. And imagine what the challenges are going to face those who are in grade school or high school with this, what are going to be tremendous cuts in funding and disarray. And then when they try to go on to college, how are they going to get college grants and stuff? I mean, it's deeply unsettling. And then the last thing I'll say is, what does the business community have to say about this? Because our education system prepares the workforce. And what economic impact is it going to have? What, without the kind of data that's needed, you know, what is the overall, do they have any overall concern about the impact this will have on preparing our workforce? I think it doesn't bode well for our country.
Mark Whitman.
Joe, my first reaction to this was not to write the obituary yet. I'm not sure I remember which Republican administration didn't toy with the idea of closing the Department of Education. And my understanding is in order to officially close it, you'd need the 60% or 60 votes in the Senate, which hopefully you'd have to suspect anyway that Chuck Schumer's learned his lesson on caving into the Republicans on this one. So I'm not so sure the actual reconfiguration of the education department's duties will take place. And there was an interesting quote from a senior advisor to the education department, Dan Correll, who said, "The only thing the Department of Education definitely doesn't do is education. Remember, it's responsible for distributing funds and overseeing functions, right?" So But one has to worry if this isn't part of the three-card Monty game that the Republicans are playing, and whether or not they accomplish this actual shutdown of the department, that they fail to support some of the many programs that are so important around the United States. The other thing that gives me pause here is, you know, we have a system that hasn't caught up to the pandemic learning loss. There are a couple of studies out recently that highlight that blue states seem to have been more affected by the learning loss during COVID and the inability to catch up, which isn't all that surprising if you think about which states closed their schools sooner and kept them closed for longer. So when you think about distributing even any more power to the states, the extent that they have any, you have to be sort of doubly concerned at the lack of some sort of central oversight, because certainly when you talk about programs around, I guess, what we now call DEI, we used to just have simple names for it, like equal rights. When you think about programs like that, you can certainly come up with your list of states that you would suspect would be less careful in how they teach children than others. And certainly the pandemic has underscored the fact that states don't always make the best decisions either. So watering down the oversight at the federal level should also be somewhat concerning to us as well. So I'm not writing the obituary for the department itself, but I'm also not very optimistic that the Trump administration is going to make education this education system better off than they found it at the end of these 4 years.
Bill Hammond.
So on a previous show, I said of all the things Trump is doing, this bothers me the least. I will say that the process here is crazy. You know, the idea that you would try to eliminate a department created by state law, created by Congress, that you would try to do it with an executive order is just like, needlessly disruptive. Like he's going to lay off lots of employees. That'll be challenged in court. He won't, as Mark says, he's not going to get Congress's permission to follow through. But I think the quote that Mark had about this department doesn't do any education, it is a mechanism for distributing funding. And it's a bureaucracy. The funding, again, is authorized by law. Barring a change by Congress, it ought to continue. It'll probably, I think we don't know what the president's idea is here, but I'm assuming he would assign those funding programs to other departments. I've heard it quoted that the federal government's responsible for 10% of education funding. It's responsible for maybe 1% of policymaking. The at least in New York, the state has a strong role and the localities have a strong role. I think the bureaucracy could go away and a lot of people wouldn't notice. So for an example of something that the bureaucracy has tried to do, it's tried to do social engineering in the schools. The right has its social engineering about restricting what books people can read and what topics they can talk about. And the left has social engineering when they want to introduce non-educational topics into the schools. I would want, if it was up to me, I would want us to have national standards for education. I would want us to have a national curriculum. I'd want us to have a whole national system of testing, not unlike the UK. We don't have that, and it's just not in our political blood. And to, you know, that being the case, the federal education bureaucracy isn't serving a great purpose. Again, I actually think what Teresa brought up about the stuff that's happening with research funding, that, you know, to universities, that's a much bigger deal for our education system than than what's happening with the education department.
I want to go to, let's go to a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. I'll hear from the rest of the panel. We have some follow-up questions, and then we'll get to questions that come from the audience. We welcome those. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, as we talk about the executive order that will seem to dismantle, I believe is the word they're using, right. Dismantle the Department of Education. Bill Hammond, Kristen Van Genhoven, George, and Mark Whitman, and Teresa Bourgeois with us. We will return after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 20th day of March. We have been talking about President Trump signing an order aimed at dismantling the education department. You were mentioning, Teresa, that your parents were both teachers. My father worked for years, retired with 35 years in the federal government. And they were nice enough to add his time in World War II to that, which I thought was nice. But he worked for the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. And it was Reagan, ultimately, who then tore those apart, right?
That indeed is correct. And when you look, I was looking at all the different functions of the Department of Education last night, and many of them grew out of that, the health, education, welfare. They moved over because he wanted to consolidate and focus.
H-E-W.
Indeed.
It wasn't Carter that started the department?
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
But Reagan.
Of H-E-W or of education.
Of education, I thought.
We'll check.
Yeah, it was Jimmy Carter that started the Department of Education as we know it today.
But I mean, so Reagan would have taken over that job when he became president.
Correct.
Probably, because yes. I know he was a supporter of it.
Yes.
Maybe it started under Carter. I think of it as Reagan.
We'll check
because
that
as out. He was dismantling so many other things, he was trying to concentrate education in one place.
So we're talking about the dismantling of the education department in the United States of America. Let's get a Canadian perspective.
Oh, excellent, excellent. I actually have the page up that says, understand the Canadian education system. So I'm just going to read it because some people might be thinking, the questions are you thinking about studying abroad in Canada or sending your child to study in Canada? If you are, Canada is recognized for its quality education at all levels. Now, what's interesting is that Canada's provincial and territorial governments are responsible for education. They do follow government standards to ensure high-quality public education across the country, which speaks to what you were saying. School is mandatory for children from about the ages of 6 to 18. And then it finishes with saying, our study environments are safe and welcoming. Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. Isn't that a nice philosophy? You'll discover a world of possibilities. So like so many things in this current administration, this is not about the what. This is about the how. Because everything, the how of how he does things is so inhumane, not to mention illegal and unconstitutional and all of the other adjectives we can attribute to it. So I would say it's not necessarily about the what, right? There are many points of view for the Department of Education or points of view against the Department of Education, but it's about how he's doing these things in terms of, A, if you are going to phase out a department because you believe that there is a more effective way to ensure that the constituents that you represent receive a quality education that is safe and welcoming, which I'm sure we can all agree is not the goal of this current administration, then you do have to get the support of Congress through legislation. We also know that is not how this current administration approaches how it wants to change things. So I do believe that the funding is important. I believe, like everything else that he's doing, this affects the most vulnerable. It affects the disability funding, you know, the special education funding. It affects the things that those of us in this room and the 75 million people who voted for Kamala Harris, plus many tens of millions of the others, I would hope, value. And so, like everything else he's doing, it's the most vulnerable that will be affected, although the point that they take is that they're doing this because the vulnerable are being attacked, which is just such global gaslighting that it's difficult to wrap your head around, honestly. And so I do think there are some arguments to say that this may not be, maybe the departments get merged again. Maybe there's a different way to approach the various points that are valid about considering this option. But like with everything else, the how he's doing it, I obviously am going to have massive issue with. So I would say that's what I have to add. But I think we should have started with the person who is actually still studying at this point, because the rest of us are past that point. I don't think any of us are currently enrolled in school. So I would love to hear. I saw George had taken some notes, so I'd be curious to hear what the student in the room has to offer.
Lay it on us, George.
I mean, well, if you're this administration and you're not going to help children, it doesn't matter what department you don't do it in.
Well, that's an interesting point. Yes, absolutely. I did check this out that it was 1979, the United States Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. In 1979, a separate Department of Education was created from this department, and HEW was renamed as the Department of Health and Human Services under President James Earl Carter. To this date, this was the only department of the U.S. government to be created through presidential reorganization authority.
Just like this will be the first one to be dismantled.
But that there must have been a law that was passed after. Yeah. Because
to allow for it.
Because now it is established by law.
Correct. Okay. Yes. All right. So that's what that's our little history lesson on that.
Hmm.
Teresa, how long do you think, or when you look at, here's my main question. So now who does that? I understand the whole thing about the states, but who is the overseer, the governing body that oversees what is happening within the states when it comes to education?
So this is what really bothers me, because it is a process question that has incredible impact. They are doing it not unlike with Social Security, where they say they're not touching it, but they are, the DOGE people. Or you can go, it's not just Social Security. They have a whole list, a new list came out last night, of all these leases that they've canceled for departments across the board, from Indian Affairs to the FBI to but tons and tons of Social Security offices, right? With no discussion about what's the impact, how is that going to work? And in this case, with the Department of Education, they're saying we're dismantling it. They just shut down the and I know you all say, well, they need the by law they need Congress to agree. Well, yes. But what they're doing is laying everybody off. They are freezing funds. They don't seem to have any plan. So, and Trump just keeps saying, we're going to push it back to the states. We're going to push it back to the states. Well, as we've all said, we all agree that policy already is with the states. It's with the states and localities. But it's the bigger picture. Who's going to implement FAFSA program? Right, which is how you apply for and get your student loans. Who's going to manage the student loan system? Who's going to do, Mark, you were citing data. You know that data presumably because the Department of Education has a whole division on data science. It's one of the big things that they do. They collect and analyze data so that you have a sense of where you're going. Who's going to do that? There doesn't seem to be a plan. The plan seems to be, where can we cut across the board because we need money to offset the cost of the tax cuts? That's what Trump wants. And for the Project 2025 people, they just don't, they really haven't believed in public education for a long time, right? They want to privatize, they want to have it with the localities, they don't want to have the funding. And so there isn't a plan. And what's...
Well, that is the plan. I mean, that is the end plan. That's what it seems to be, right?
When you... Well, but Trump says, oh, it's going to be great. It's going to be so much better.
If you wanted to privatize education and you were President Trump, you would do it through the Education Department. So he's taking away, if that was his goal, the tool that he would use to do that is being, he's eliminating. He's just backing away from education policy and saying it's all up to you, states. I agree that the how here, as Kristen said, it's awful. It's crazy. It's bonkers. It's destructive. It's creating all kinds of uncertainty. That is just not the way to do things.
That is the point. I mean, that's what they're doing, right? When the folks that are on the side of, like, this is the Project 2025 playbook, the goal is to flood the zone, to increase the uncertainty, to have people and do the shock and awe. And then, you know, reading various different opinion articles about this, the idea is over the first couple of years of the administration, you really deplete the financial and emotional reserves of folks as we're all running around trying to answer the questions that Teresa just asked, right? How is that all going to happen? So in the last 2 years, we're completely exhausted. We're financially depleted, and they can really do the real damage. That's the view of the Project 2025, the folks that are saying this is what is happening. That playbook is now becoming a reality.
It's not unlike... And it's not unlike what they're doing with the ACA, the healthcare, right? The so-called Obamacare. What they're trying to, they can't do repeal and replace. They've tried that for years. It doesn't work, right? Because they don't have consensus on what they replace it with. They want to tear it down, but they don't know how to build something else up, right? So what do? They shorten the time frame in which you apply. They lay off a vast majority of the people who are there to enroll people. They make cuts in all sorts of areas. So basically, it caves in on itself. That's what they appear to be doing with Social Security.
Yeah.
You make it harder for people to apply. You make it harder for people to get
the... Well, especially the most vulnerable.
The most vulnerable. So what they're doing is they're... they are creating the, so they need Congress to officially do it, but they make it so it doesn't work, and then they say how terrible they are because it's bureaucracy that doesn't work. Oh, we don't need it anymore because it doesn't work.
But do they need Congress anymore to do that? I mean, well, I think by law just they proven do. That. Yeah, but do they care about that?
I don't know if they care anymore. But
yeah, I don't think we're in that.
Well, I think in order to scrape the actual letters off the building. And officially shut it down, I think they need Congress.
Well, they did literally scrape the letters off the building in USAID, and they did not legally have the right to do that.
Yeah,
and
so now they're...
The come back and said, yeah. Are they going to put the letters back up?
Yeah, right. Well, now the question is, what can they put back in the building that's going to approximate a functioning USAID at the end?
And by
the
way, they said, oh, it's not hurting anybody, and... Nick Kristof, by the way, look at his amazing reporting. He's gone around the country, the world, and he's documenting how many children are dying, how many other people are dying right now because of those cuts.
They're in a mode of
destruction.
Seeking forgiveness rather than seeking permission, except they probably aren't going to ask for forgiveness.
No, I was going to say, of course they're not.
Oh, I think that misses. I mean, I
the steamroller do that's where. That
yeah, I think that's a often used term, and I get why you're saying that, but I think in a way. It misses the point here, which is they're going to break as much as they can. And then when they're forced to put the letters back on the building, they will. The question
is,
there won't
be anybody inside
the building. Right. They will have broken so many of the functions within the building that it will be impossible to reclaim what the building was doing. And they're okay with that because they want a lot less money to go out the door. And that's going to happen by virtue of what they've done. I think the Department of Education is a great example, though, of why the patient is sick. Because I thought to myself, okay, if I really did want to carefully dismantle the Department of Education, where would you put everything? And you start with the fact that schools within territories administered by Indian authorities are not inside of the Department of Education, nor are the schools administered by the Department of Defense. So first off, you've sort of not covered all schools to begin with. Then you've got a myriad of programs. I mean, Health and Human Services still does Head Start and early Head Start. The Department of Labor obviously has some role in training and in Jobs Corps. As I mentioned, the Department of Defense runs their own school program. the Department of Education does school lunches. So
and NIH turns out to be the major source of funding for higher education.
Right. So
and DARPA.
And it's like the Air Force, right? I think there are five different Air Forces in the United States. So if you when the patient comes in, you're like, oh, you're sick. This is the wiring for how we do things within the federal government. It needs to be thought through and carefully redone. But I think
that's not what's happening, Mark.
No, of course. That's why back to the original point, which is they're scraping the letters off, emptying the buildings, and then to the extent that they're forced to put the letters back up, they're hoping that they don't have to put the actual functions back up. And in the meantime, we have clear examples, and it's a little bit odd to me that the Republicans aren't making more hay out of this. But the learning loss seems to have been far more severe in blue states. It seems to be you could track that back to
why. But again, why do you know that? You know that because this Department of Education has done research to try to figure it out.
Agreed.
That's why you know it.
So, Ben, let's go. What?
So you think it'd be better if you didn't know that because you didn't have the data?
No, I'm not. That's not my issue. So then you say, okay, we have a learning loss. The federal government realizes it, and it sends out nearly $200 billion. Well, what happens? The schools that suffer the most learning loss tend to be those in economically disadvantaged areas, and they use the funds, not entirely surprisingly, to do things like make sure the ceilings aren't falling down on children and not for tutoring, so they don't close the gap as effectively as the red states do. So the gap that did exist in all places got closed.
Well, actually,
so it argues for the fact that at the same time,
one at a time,
it argues for the
just
fact,
like in school,
that at the same time we're saying, oh, the states will fix this on their own. We're acknowledging that some degree of centralized thought and care about what we do on behalf of students in this country needs to probably be buttressed at the exact same time that we're dispersing the authority even further.
So I just have to step in here and say one of the big blue states with big learning loss was the state of New York, where we sit right now. The state of New York has the number one spending per pupil of any state. It's not even close. The lowest spending school district in New York State spends more than the national average per pupil. The federal aid that's coming in is just icing on that cake. And if we're suffering learning loss in that context, in the context of the richest funded school system in the country, how much difference is federal aid going to make? It's not closing a gap. It's going on top of a very high level of funding. And I guess I would also add that the guidance that we need is not coming from the federal government. They're not setting standards. They're not enforcing standards. I'm assuming that the learning loss data came from the Education Department, but
I don't know for sure.
Yeah,
but I'm guessing
I don't know
it
for
is,
sure
because they are the ones that mostly do the.
Yeah,
when I look for data on schools, I don't expect it from the Education Department. I expect it from Governing Magazine or the Census Bureau. Like that's where you know.
Or it's funded by, but.
Can
so,
I just wait? Let me just respond to Bill's point, and then I'll let you go. Bill, you and I are saying the same thing, which is these states, and not surprisingly New York State, need some adult supervision in how they conduct these activities. And
they're not going to get it from this administration.
That's the point. At the same time, we need to say
the Obama administration. They didn't get it from the.
Yeah, but at the same time, we need to say, look, maybe we need to turn the dial the other way. And you're buttressing that point. We're actually, you know, in addition to the letters on the front of the building, we're ripping the dial off the machine as well. Go ahead, Teresa.
Well, I'm going to hold you because we have to take a break, and otherwise we get in trouble. So we don't want to get anybody in trouble.
We don't want to get Joe in trouble.
No. Well, we'd all get
send
in
him to the principal's
That's
office.
Right. And I don't have the hall pass for that. So we're going to take a break. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion, our rumble in the streets here in
the rumble of the intellectual streets.
Yes, in the Studio A, and we're happy. I had to cut you off for a moment, Teresa. Go ahead, please. You have the floor.
Well, I am concerned about this notion that, well, if it's not working right, they're all just bureaucrats, get rid of them, it doesn't matter. And the question is, do we know if it will matter or not? is the having the research available, does that matter? Having an infrastructure to facilitate student loans, who's going to do that? How's that going to work? Maybe it doesn't matter. Maybe we don't need student loans. Are we going to leave that to the states? Shall we do that? Shall we just leave student loans to the states? Shall we forget about Pell Grants so those who are most disadvantaged?
If you can't afford to go to school, I guess you shouldn't
should
be
you
able
to
school?
Go to school. Because we don't need that.
No.
Let's skip the Pell Grants. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, the Trump administration has dismantled most of the economic justice programs anyway, which, by the way, you were talking about school buildings, right? Well, the Biden administration did have funding particularly targeted to the 40% of the funding to improve schools and improve public buildings and other things had to go to economic justice areas, right? But that has been completely dismantled. So that's where schools post-COVID could have gotten some help, didn't need to use their teacher money because the Biden administration provided resources and the technical assistance needed for those schools that don't have the technical capacity or communities to do it, right? But we're not for that. So we don't need loans. We don't need the workforce development programs. We've got some in labor, but the businesses are going to train their folks on their own and figure out what the priorities are in the next 5 to 10 years, where the gaps are. Okay. So is that really what you guys are saying? Because they're just
I think
a bunch
of
bureaucrats.
All of us around this table generally agree.
Nobody
well,
said
no,
that.
They
literally
don't agree.
Nobody
but
said
we
that.
All agree that there is no plan except to get rid of the things that, you know, as has been discussed on this program many, many, many times. I want to go back to, I'm so glad that, Mark, you have the optimism that they're actually going to put the letters back on the buildings and have some kind of semblance of something to follow. Because I think they seem to be using the same playbook that he's used his entire career of appeal, 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 and just let it kind of sit in the courts and not actually be forced to do anything. I can't imagine this particular administration allowing itself to be forced to do anything. So,
well, so
I'm glad. I hope you
but
know,
how
we'll
do you
see.
Reconfigure the expertise? And the courts is going to take a
they
couple of years.
They don't care about the expertise. They're not thinking about reconfiguring. These are
but
great questions, but this is not the administration to be considering and reflecting
so
on those questions.
There is my instincts are telling me. I could be completely wrong because Donald Trump's instincts have turned out to be much stronger than mine when it comes to stuff like this. But this approach that he's taking to government, setting aside the education department, this approach that he's taking to government, he and Elon Musk, there's going to be a price to pay.
One
I don't think any, if the education department shuts down, I'm not sure anybody's going to notice. When the Social Security Department can't answer its phones and can't process paperwork, that's going to be a big deal. When the parks don't open, when the, you know, it, there's any number of things, it's like too many to even think of right now, where we do depend on a basic level of competence from the federal government. He is eviscerating the competence of the federal government, just in terms of the number of personnel who are there to answer the phone and process the paperwork. At some point, that's going to hit home for average people, and they're going to be pissed off. And there will be a political price to pay for this bull in the china shop approach to the government. That's, I think, what we have to rely on, because that is, like, if that's not true, if the Social Security Department stops answering its phones and the public is okay with that,
that has
implications for, well, maybe we don't understand how our society works, but I think we do. I think people do count on Social Security and they need the phones to be answered.
We have a 30-second warning. Go ahead.
I don't think that people think about, I think that they've just demonized bureaucracy, 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 and they don't understand the ways in which it's helped them. Take NOAA, the weather service. Most people, they get their weather, get their information on their phones. They have no idea where that originates from. That information originates from NOAA and goes out to all of these other entities. They've already shut down research. They've already shut down centers. What's going to be the people don't realize that that's
the
information from NOAA.
They will realize soon. when
it's all
planes.
But how do you put
for
it back?
8 or 10 or 12 years since the Golden Escalator, haven't we been saying people are going to realize how destructive this is? People
oh no!
No, but what they're doing right now is very different. Yeah, what they're doing in the last 40 days, however many,
we will finally hit rock bottom. Is that where we're going?
It's just
is
a fundamentally different type of action that he's taking.
This is all unprecedented. And
well,
dangerous.
I hate to interrupt, and especially when we talk about hitting rock bottom, and then we go to Ray. So let's
with his Met shirt on,
because that's far from rock bottom. That's the best. That's the peak. So we're gonna take a break. We're gonna get to letters when we come back. We'll go to a few announcements. We'll hear Ray, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable on this Thursday morning. That's right, Thursday, March 20th, and it's a delight to have you all here. Public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois joins us. Bill Hammond, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, and theater artist, arts advocate, activist, and executive director for Project SAGE in Lakeville, Connecticut, Kristen Van Ginhoven, is here. Investment banker in Wall Street, Mark Whitman, joins us along with his son, George, and that is our group for this Thursday morning. All right, let's go to letters on this subject and try to figure out what people are thinking as we work our way through the subject this morning. I will say that we always welcome your letters at panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. From Micah, I think the panel is getting this fundamentally wrong.
Okay.
Trump and Musk don't have a different approach to government. They want no government. They don't believe in a public. They believe that they are exceptional and that they deserve to claim to themselves the world's resources. As for Trump, add to this a very sick need for vengeance combined with the likely fact that he can make it through the remaining years of his life very comfortably with his current billions. And you have a character who has no hold on his desire to just blow it all up. That from Micah. Then we go to Glenn. I hear many times on the panel that, quote, people don't realize the this or that regarding the impacts of Musk's activities. Somehow only panel members have somehow figured out what's going on. That's really arrogant of you all. Okay. I don't think it's arrogance. I think that we are talking about looking at polls of people who have a grasp fully of what is happening in various issues. I don't think it is arrogance. I think it is a understanding that we are political nerds and spend a lot of time looking over these issues and reading articles where many people do not. There is nothing wrong with either of those pursuits, but so.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guilty of that. I'm the one who said that. And what I meant is I really object to this broad stroke denigration of bureaucrats. And that's really what I mean. And I'm not sure that people understand generally that the general public, and I'll repeat it again, like Noah, I don't think the general public has an understanding of where the weather data comes from and that it relies on government research to provide the weather data. Because where do they hear it from? They hear it from their local meteorologist. And how are they to know that their local meteorologist gets it because it's provided by the federal government through a department called NOAA, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, right? That's kind of an obscure fact. I just think most people don't know that. Or they know that they can get student loans, but do most people know where that mechanism originates from? And I think, you know, one of the things you find when the government shuts down, people begin to realize the mechanisms of how things work. But I object more broadly to this blanket denigration of quote-unquote bureaucrats because it's a lot of hardworking people. Yes, there could be more efficiencies. There always could be things could be done better. But I really object to this blanket denigration of quote-unquote bureaucrats.
I would actually say during this time, from his first administration to the 2.0, there is the positive thing that more people are actually being made aware of how the system works, because more numbers have been engaging in learning how things work, and the way things work has been more in the mainstream media because it's being dismantled or attacked or whatever. So people are learning how the Electoral College works, or how the weather comes to you, or how Social Security ends up in your account. You know, so that I do think that is one plus, that people are getting more engaged. I do agree that as a general statement, the level of political engagement that folks has is really across the spectrum. And, you know, how much are people looking into how all these things are done? Although in the time of social media, it's a lot easier to get all that information. I also think that I read something a few weeks ago that I made notes about, that we as humans are horrendously ill-equipped to deal with sustained uncertainty and unknowns. Like, we're conditioned to run from unknowns, right? Because we can't deal with it. We have very few.
Been doing it for 57 years.
So I think that combined with the, you know, not being educated or taking the time or being exposed to how the systems work, those two things together, I also think the current administration relies on that, that people are not going to rise up, are not going to become equipped, are not going to be worried when the social, they'll be worried about it, but what they're going to do about it, I don't know. They'll go to town halls and they'll be really upset at their, you know, will they be, and then maybe hopefully at the midterms things change, if there's midterms, if there's an election. But those are some thoughts in response to that current letter.
Oh, go ahead, Bill.
The very good writer Michael Lewis has a new book out. It's kind of a compendium of essays about star government officials, star bureaucrats.
Yes.
And, you know, there's somebody in the bureaucracy who figured out how to prevent coal mines from collapsing and save thousands of lives, stuff like that. And another thing he pointed out, I heard an interview with him, was that we depend on the federal government for our understanding of reality. And by that, I mean not just the weather, but also, like, Mark probably pays close attention to labor reports and, you know, reports on whether the economy is growing or not. That data, which drives an awful lot of not just government decision making, but also a lot of private and personal decision making, is generated by people in the federal bureaucracy. And we depend on it in ways I'm not even sure we think about. And it's sort of like the Joni Mitchell song, you don't know what you've got till it's gone. If NOAA stops functioning, if the FAA stops functioning, if the Bureau of Labor Statistics stops functioning, we're going to be like Wile E. Coyote, you know, like we're going to go off the cliff and we're going to realize there's nothing under us. And it's going to be very disorienting.
But not as funny.
Yeah, yeah. And then the anvil's going to fall on our heads. It's going to be a mess. We're going to be flattened, but then we're going to pop back to normalcy. This is why I say I think what they're doing, it's never nothing like this has ever happened in the United States before, where the person in charge of the federal government is taking a sledgehammer to the federal government in real time. Like, And not following any procedures or norms. He's going to break things that he doesn't even mean to break. And at some point, if those things are important, and I believe they are, people are going to notice and they're not going to be happy. And they may not blame Trump or Musk. Somehow, we don't always blame the right people. But they'll call their congressmen. They'll go to the town halls and stuff like that. And the anger will bubble up and it'll start to.
Well, and David Brooks said something similar before the election, of sort of traveling around the country and thinking people were not there yet, what you're talking about. They were not they hadn't hit that point where they thought that this was going to be something that, you know, this was the time they had to vote against it, that it hadn't gotten bad enough. And I think what you're saying is it's going to get bad enough that people are going to rise up in a new way. I hope you're right. I have not seen evidence of that to this point. And while this, while what you say is true, that nothing like this has ever happened to this point, there are still so many people that approve of what he's doing. And there is such a apathy to get up and do something. I maintain my thought that unless like 90 million people descend upon Washington, D.C. and say, like, you can't do this to us, what does he care?
Well, I do think that there are people who are speaking out. Again, I'll mention, I think Congressman Tonko has been doing some very interesting things. We're bringing together fired federal employees to talk about what they do so people have an understanding of, so what are the gaps, particularly around veterans benefits and Social Security. And I think other members of Congress are beginning to do more and more of that. He's actually been on national TV now a couple of times, Congressman Tonko, given the way he's presenting these issues, which I think are very impressive. And I do think that organizations are trying to get the word out, putting personal stories so people make the connection, because the Trump people are trying to label all this as waste, fraud, and abuse. But in fact, like, if you listen to the veterans workers' stories, they're the ones who do the hard work of taking care of ill veterans, or they're the ones who do the measuring weather, whatever. And I do think there has to be a lot more of education about that. But where is the breaking point where it can't be rebuilt? I mean, and I was listening last night to a story which was so unsettling. I mean, I know it's happening, but to see real-time data, where there was an international network of people who track the spread of illness. Like, how did we know so quickly about the pandemic? Because there was this international network of people who were tracking that, or Ebola outbreaks. And it costs a lot less, and it costs less money and fewer lives to try to stop it at the outbreak than to have it spread. But this network now doesn't exist anymore, mm-hmm. because much of it was through AID, and the USAID had people all over the world, and then others was funded through AID in other countries, and the CDC in this country, they've dismantled large components of that. So you don't have the tracking and the reporting anymore, and that's a problem.
I do want to get to more letters, and then I do want to get to other topics too.
Sorry.
But we seem to have some momentum on this, so I don't want to screw it up. All right, let's go to this, and I'll try to rip through these pretty good. If anybody has anything to say, please go ahead. Al says, "What's so great about the status quo of our educational institutions, given that we have elected Trump twice? Our educational institutions failed to produce a sufficient number, of competent citizens capable of constitutional self-government. If there will be an opportunity to do so, we must build back better." Then we go to Matt. I just wanted to chime in regarding your analysis of the seemingly nonsensical things that the Trump administration is doing, such as your discussion about the Education Department. The reasons for this and the other things they have done and will do have already been disseminated within, one, Project 2025, two, the GOP's historic goals, and three, the philosophy of dark enlightenment that J.D. Vance, Elon Musk, I also almost called him Elton Musk. That would have been great. J.D. Vance, Elon Musk, and many other billionaires subscribe to as well. The administration's end goals are in plain sight, and unfortunately, they're not in the public's interest. Either way, thank you for not being afraid to discuss the topics you bring up each morning. Then, Rachel, your panelist has absolutely no understanding of how grants that assist with learning loss works and how to approach learning issues. There was a principal in Brooklyn who used grant money to buy washers and dryers so that parents would bring their kids to school to get more involved in the community, and test scores and attendance among the kids went way up. It is not about just hiring tutors. Also, red states maybe suffered less learning loss because they are the least successful in education. Anyway, have you seen Kentucky's numbers? Asks Rachel.
Just on one point, it's not the case that the reason the blue state suffered more loss was because they were in a higher position to begin with. Their relative loss and relative lack of reclaiming has been more severe. So that was actually looked at least one of the studies that I reviewed.
Anthony writes, Trump famously said he likes uneducated people, the dismantling of the Department of Education, and the more fervent attacks on the best colleges are part of his scheme to make the populace as dumb as he is. It was shameful the way Columbia's president cowed before that pseudo-intellectual Elise Stefanik. Then we go to this letter from Rachel. I find the nonchalant attitude of several panel members regarding the shuttering of DOE off-putting. I am not a parent of the special needs kids, but my friends who are parents of these children are very frightened. Terrifying. The Department of Education is the enforcement arm of IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. IDEA is the reason kids with special needs get an education in public schools. Mm-hmm. Important point. Then we go to Rick. So Teresa is asking why this went, referring to cutting the Department of Education. It's so obvious that all of the cuts and moves that this administration is making are simply ways to channel taxpayer money to private corporations. They want a privatized education and make charter schools the norm and take away public education because public education is not profitable. That's all they care about. Someday America will learn that running a country is not running a business. And then our final letter that we will get to this morning is from Matthew. Not in general, but on this issue. Matthew says they attack the Department of Education because the need to have people uneducated is important to them. The rich need uneducated people to work in the mines, the factories, the jobs, the robots won't be able to do. Grants and loans are not needed by the rich for education. And that is from Matthew.
If I can also add, on page 327 of Project 2025, to answer Teresa's question of what should happen to federal student aid, this says that the next administration should completely reverse the student loan federalization of 2010 and work with Congress to spin off FSA and its student loan obligation to a new government corporation with professional governance and management. So I think that's what we'll see happening in the next 6 months or so.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I know Senator Simon years ago when I was working in the Congress was trying to improve the student loan issue, and that kind of structure came up. But I mean, I know that they're very good at breaking things. I don't know how good they are at putting them back together. But I know it's all there. And I do think that there are really three tracks that are happening. I think Trump's on the vengeance tour. You know, that's what he's focused on, his revenge tour. But I do think that the whole Project 2025 America First Foundation, they're the ones who are doing the nuts and bolts of this. And then, mm-hmm. But Musk separately, and that's really the thing that I think is so unexpected. He and his team going in, shutting down websites, sending out notices of cancellation, of termination of leases through the GSA, things of that sort. And the thing I'm just astounded as people aren't more worried about the fact that their data, whether it's from the Treasury, IRS, the Social Security, Health and Human Services, is being run through these AI systems of Musk's. I mean, it's almost like there's been this massive data breach that people aren't appalled at. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, and maybe you guys know, they haven't signed any confidentiality agreements, have they? I mean, they're operating as a side entity that has access to all of our data and almost unfettered access. And they're changing it, right? Have they signed any contracts? Do we know anything about? I haven't found anything about confidentiality agreements, contracts, anything. The Musk.
Yeah, my understanding is that those employees have been subject to far less a review in the way of background checks. And
are they employees? They're Musk's employees. Yeah, employed by companies that they work for? They're not employed by the...
Yeah, look, again, I think that one of the complaints we've heard is that they've been subject to a lot less review than would ordinarily be the case. And I think the headline is what It was Kara Fisher who said that she strongly suspects or wonders aloud if Musk isn't using the data that he's getting access to
train his,
for his own
his,
for his own means. Yeah. What? Well, there are lots of things he's probably using it for, including, or he could be using it for, let's say, including getting visibility into government contracts that go to his competitors, information that he can potentially use through his AI system and other uses that we would all find objectionable.
And without competitive bidding, taking over a portion of this FAA contract that was to go to the awarded to Verizon, right, where he's now going to get a piece of this for the Starlink system.
Yeah, the other
with no process.
The other interesting fact is that the day before he disassembled the Consumer Protection Agency. I'm getting the name exactly wrong, but
the Financial Protection Board.
Thank you. The day before he did that, he, in his auspices as the owner of X, signed a contract with one of the credit card companies that's designed towards taking a step in making X a everything platform, including payments. So let's just think about that for 1 second. So on Monday, he signed a contract to make X a payment platform, and on Tuesday, he disassembles Consumer Protection Agency that's supposed to oversee that type of activity. So, I think there's lots of reasons to be acutely concerned here in terms of his actions with data and his actions vis-a-vis the companies that he owns, let alone the showroom on the front lawn of the White House. And I think people are generally aware of it. As to the level of concern nationally, I can't speak to that. I know Kara Fisher and others are concerned, and therefore I am.
Yeah, she's made me concerned listening to her. And also, just remember that the people from the IG's office from the USAID testified at a hearing in December. And in their testimony, and I went back to actually read this because I wanted to be sure before I saw it. I wanted to see it with my – before I said it, I want to see it with my own eyes. But they talked about a number of key oversight investigations they were doing. And then at the end, they referenced two other major investigations that were underway that they would report on soon, and one of them was of Starlink, of Elon Musk's Starlink. And those people were part of the purge of inspector generals, and then, as you know, he then led the effort to dismantle USAID.
So one of the...
Wait 30 seconds. Go ahead.
So Trump famously is all about breaking norms, and this is that on steroids. They're ignoring regulations. They're ignoring laws. They're ignoring, you know, acts of Congress. They're ignoring ethical considerations. They're just blowing past everything. And the reason they're able to do that is no one is stopping them. And there's Congress and the courts are the only ones that can stop them. Congress is not doing anything. The courts are trying.
More after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable. We have our last go-around with this terrific panel, and we have been spending time, and I think it's a good time because we haven't really kind of dug into the issue of the Education Department, so I'm glad we got to do that this morning. We got to a lot of letters and got to a lot of thoughts from our wonderful panelists. So that leaves us with several topics that we haven't gotten to yet. So I would like to do a lightning round on those if we can. And we'll do our best to get through as many things as we possibly can. Mark Whitman, you're up. Feds holds rates steady. The Fed does so and predicts higher inflation, slower growth ahead. That according to the New York Times. A different headline in the Wall Street Journal, Fed extends pause on rates, cuts outlook with growth. Officials said they expect GDP growth of 1.7% in 2025, down from their December numbers. What should we make of this?
Well, partially it's the Fed covering their back end on inflation. Inflation would have been higher than the Fed predicted anyway. The uncertainty caused by the tariffs has given the Fed cover to admit that, frankly. Additionally, It's clear that GDP would have grown less quickly this year in the United States if for no other reason than in the first quarter of this year, there was a surge in imports, people basically anticipating the possibility of higher tariffs, ordering earlier and getting items into inventory before effectively their net delivered price increased. So it was inevitable that growth outlooks, and just to be clear from the way gross domestic product or GDP is calculated, imports are actually a deduction to that because it's something that we don't produce. It's produced elsewhere. So in a way, the Fed's kind of realizing the obvious. The markets were slightly happy, though, because the Fed basically maintained its outlook that it would potentially cut rates twice this year. I'm not so sure. I'm convinced that's going to happen, and that's because I still think the Fed hasn't fully made up for its sins around the money supply, and therefore inflation was going to run hotter than it had been projected to run nonetheless.
It's such a relief to talk about something that's sane and calm and normal and rational. And
but
go ahead.
It's like a little oasis.
Yeah.
Go ahead, George.
The last time the Fed cut rates was about, like, what, a year ago?
Yeah.
And it looked like they were trying to help out Biden. And now, as a ref in most sports would call a makeup call to make things seem more fair, the Fed is kind of handling Trump's economic shakeup with kid gloves.
We were talking about that this morning. I think it's true. I think the Fed is – but the Fed's been far less critical of the potential effects of the tariffs on the United States economy, in part because theoretically they could work out. But I also think the Fed got caught last year trying to give Biden a tailwind, and they're trying to sort of stay out of Trump's wrath here, which by the way,
draw the eye of Sauron. You
know? Yeah, which, by the way, I think people missed. This is way afield, so I apologize, but not really, because I want to say this. I think people missed what John Roberts was doing with his proclamation the other day. You know, the only time we've seen something like this in this country is actually,
for people who don't know, say Supreme Court.
John Fassos, John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. John Fassos kind of got to this when he said, you know, FDR was in a battle with, and because basically FDR stood up this state that we have. He basically built this thing in the course of, you know, his first administration, if you will. So he had to break a lot of norms and maybe laws. And if you remember, a switch in time saves nine. The Supreme Court, for fear of his wrath and the political ramifications of disappointing him, there was actually Robert Owens, I believe, or Owens Roberts, whatever the guy's name was, one of the justices, switched votes and maintained basically an FDR-friendly posture that probably saved the court as nine people and stopped FDR from packing it. I truly believe Roberts was not talking about this particular justice. I think Roberts was signaling to Trump, we're not playing ball with you when this stuff gets here. We're going to stand in your way. And I was really heartened to see that. I don't think it's an accident for the third time in 20 years he's made a pronouncement like that. And I think it had nothing to do with Venezuelans being sent to El Salvador. I think it was a sign to Trump.
All right, let's continue the lightning round as we only have a few moments left. Kristen Van Genhoven, you're up. Let's talk about, I'll actually give you a choice of whether you would like to talk about Liberation Day or the Canada-EU defense talks.
Wow, they're all of a one, Joe.
Okay, all right.
They're
put
all
them together.
Of a one. I wrote Liberation Day, ye gads.
Yes. So this is the administration has already nerved investors with duties in Canada, Mexico, and China. Now they're preparing more tariffs for April 2nd on imports worth trillions, and they are doing all of this in the lead up to Liberation Day.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think there are some like actual interesting information. I've been knowing that I was coming on today. I've been listening more to like the CBC The National, which is, you know, the main news show in Canada in the evenings, and just obviously my social media is filled with a lot of Canadian friends and colleagues, and just getting a sense as I can of what the general tone is. And there are things like we're all hearing, you know, the $500,000, 500,000 less crossings in the border. Comic book, you know, did you know that all comic books get made in Canada and then they get shipped to the U.S. and then Canadian comic books stores purchase them from the U.S. so they get shipped back to Canada, right? So like in one news article they were sharing is like, if you're talking about tariffs, so it's like made in Canada, it's going to get have the tariff on it when it comes and gets all shipped to the U.S. And then it's going to have the tariff when it comes back to the store. And so all of a sudden, comic books are going to go from $4 to $12 because, you know, is it going to get the tax with every shipment across the border? So, you know, this, to me, it's very difficult in this particular case because do you not respond? Like, he's flip-flopped so many times over the past just 10 days around the tariffs. It's a very difficult position that the politicians across the world are in around, like, do you just not respond because tomorrow might be something different? Like, you do have to take the time to be prepared. And yet, they could just not happen, right? They could just go away because all the sides keep saying there's room for negotiation. There's room for negotiation. So that leads me to the other article that you asked us to look at, Joe, with the, you know, Canada boosting the EU's defense industry by becoming a credible partner. I think that is we're seeing that is clearly what the new prime minister wanted to signal first, is that I'm going to take a trip and meet with France and England and then stop at the territories on the way back.
And why wouldn't they?
Well, exactly. But is it enough? You know, I don't, obviously, it's very challenging. There's not enough time. These things didn't start early enough to combat just the mere strength of the American military. But I do think that the trust has been broken. And if nothing else, the Canadians, we are not people who are your best friend right away. We are people who sort of suss out like how you're going to be. And we keep a distance until we decide you're going to be trustworthy and loyal. And that is what has happened in the past. But now that trust has been broken. And so once the trust has been broken with a Canadian, like that is not going to get rebuilt very soon. So this path that Canada is on of boosting its relationships in other areas and the agreement that was announced yesterday with Australia, we will continue down that path because we no longer trust America to be that trusted partner. And while, you know, and that isn't how you, what everyone says, that's not how you treat your best customer. Like, we don't need you to, you know, put us up and be like, wow, you're our best customer. We're going to do everything for you. And but you can't treat us the way that you're treating us. Like, we give this country so much money every year, and you just haven't treated us in the way that we deserve. And this current administration knows that the trigger point for Canadians is the 51st state phase. We've always felt like the inferior sister, right? That even though we have a larger geographic landmass, we're always being told that, oh, you're American. That's why Canadians forever have worn their Canadian pin when going abroad, because we're so easily misidentified as Americans. And it's also why Americans have worn a Canadian pin when they've gone abroad, because they don't want to be seen as American. And that's been happening for decades. And so it's very sad. There's a lot of grief and sadness in Canada, but there's also a very strong spine around, well, you don't want us anymore. Well, then you're out. Like, we're not going to support you. We understand that there are many Americans who don't feel this way, but you voted this person in, and we don't agree with the values around it. We don't agree with the decisions that are being made, and we are going to begin and continue the journey of separating ourselves from having anything to do with you. And the Canadians are real, like, the national identity is very strong right now. And I have a lot to say about the new prime minister, but I do think in this moment, the Canadians have some faith in the intellectual rigor and experience that he has around the economy to, at least in that regard, be somebody who can navigate his way around Trump. So I have a lot more to say that I could say, but I'll pass it along.
Well, we are out of time, but a good way will let you have the last word on this topic, and I see nothing more fitting than that. So travel safely, and we hope to see you very soon. Yeah, we'll see. Let us know.
Not, I'll let you know.
And please absorb us into Canada.
Mm-hmm. My list of those who want to be adopted by me is growing, so letters to the editor will start to come in.
My thanks to our whole group this morning, Teresa Bourgeois, Bill Hammond, Kristen Vengenhoven, and Mark Whitman. You're all wonderful. George, thank you very much. Sorry you have to go back to school next week, but whenever you're off again, please join us. We'll be back right after this.